Hello. This is Christopher Holmes, and I welcome you back to another two-hour zero-point radio broadcast. The general purpose of zero-point teaching, I'm a psychologist, and I'm interested in the psychology of human consciousness, the mysteries of the human heart, and the nature of existence. In this series of talks, I try to articulate an alternate model of the nature of human existence. It's based upon the study of wide mystical spiritual teachings. So I draw from Madame Blavatsky's secret doctrine, the Kabbalah and the esoteric Judaism, mystical Christianity, yogic Vedic studies, Tibetan Buddhism, and other sources. And at the same time, I'm trying to relate these ancient teachings about the origin and nature of human consciousness. I'm relating these teachings to modern concepts in physics and science. The zero-point teaching is really quite a unique teaching in modern times, and it has two particularly distinctive aspects to it. The first, I critique what I call the head doctrine, which is what I would call a pseudoscientific belief in modern science that the human brain in the head produces human consciousness. Now, within science, there is no evidences to substantiate that the brain produces consciousness, and no one is able to say how that is done or where it is done or what this consciousness is. At the same time, the last century of modern psychology and education and science has denied the existence of the human spirit and soul. Modern times have seen the development of cognitive behavioral psychology, primarily, and dismissed the concept of psychology as the science of the soul. So what I do is that through my 30 years now of studies of mystical literature and my own personal investigations of human consciousness, I've been able to relate the ancient mystical teachings to the newest ideas emerging in modern physics. So partly I elaborate the heart doctrine, which in the mystical traditions, the true nature of the human self or of I is connected to the human heart. And the doorway to spiritual realization and to the soul life is through the awakening of the human heart. A second unique aspect to my teaching has to do with the concept of zero points. Just as our universe is now understood to have emerged from a singularity condition at the beginning of time, and that singularity is 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, an incredibly small point source origin of the universe. This is also taught in Kabbalah and the secret doctrine of Madame Blavatsky and elsewhere in the mystical literature, that creation emerges from a point source out of a seeming nothingness. I tried to explain that human consciousness, we need to understand the human being in terms of some of these same concepts, that we have a singularity point source within the higher dimensions of our hearts. That is this self that has this mystical higher dimensional nature, and it's connected to the human heart. So I expound the heart doctrine to contrast with the modern scientific head doctrine. I believe there is a systematic attempt to inculcate people and indoctrinate them into false teachings about the nature of the mind and the brain and the head, and that we've lost this ancient science of the soul. So zero-point teachings, we focus on the studies of human consciousness, the process of self-realization. I talk about the metaphysics and physics of creation. We talk about the multidimensional nature of existence and the evidences for paranormal phenomena. So we have a wide range of studies in esotericism and science. Now, I was going happily along merrily in my life until last August when I was invited to New York City for an upcoming movie called Metaphysia, which is supposed to be released in August of this year, on the new paradigm and kind of science and mysticism and the mysteries and so on. And when I came back, my son, who's 15 years old, asked me, "Dad, have you seen the movie Loose Change?" And I said, "No." And he explained to me that one of the kids in their class had showed it in class, and that everybody in class, like, they couldn't believe what they were seeing, and the teacher was horrified, and kind of no one knew what to make of it. So I watched a movie with my son, and I was absolutely astonished at what was claimed and portrayed in that movie. And so, being a scientist, I began to do my own researches, mainly through the internet, as I realized very early on that the whole mainstream of the media has systematically deceived us as to the undercurrents and things happening in our societies. So serious research into the human condition really has to mainly be conducted through the internet, I would say, at this time. So I began to study, and one thing leads to another, and from 9/11, you know, it led me along my way. I became an avid listener to Alex Jones, a crusader in the United States, who you can listen to at www.prisonplanet.com. And I may or may not agree with everything Alex Jones might be say, but he is definitely on the forefront of bringing the truth of 9/11 and the truth of the world situation. He's bringing that into public awareness. I was much happier before I knew any of this, and I've never been a political person in my life. I've always more pursued my esoteric studies and trying to, through my own experiences, awaken consciousness within myself. And then to become awakened to the horror of the larger situation of humankind on this planet is really quite a shocking experience. And the more and more you learn, in a way, the more and more deeply disturbing one realizes what has become of humanity on this planet. We live in almost in an Orwellian nightmare world, and people are deceived or hypnotized on a mass level. So I now have kind of realized, in a way, I feel I'm more like Krishna on the battlefield, or Arjuna, rather, the spiritual warrior who's kind of seeing before us on the world stage. We have forces of darkness and criminality that are rampant throughout the world, and the destructiveness of peoples, of the environment, of all the high ideals of our nations. And then on the other side, I see there are people, forces of light and life and love, which gather around the planet trying to bring forth the truth of 9/11, the truth of the world situation. And in a way, this is an epic tale which is unfolding on planet Earth at this time in our history. And the unfolding of this is going to have absolutely profound consequences for all of us through the next years. In a way, truth is a funny thing, because sometimes when truth comes out, it's like you can't hide it anymore. As a person learns the truth, it's out. It's like the truth comes out and you can't hide it. It's like trying to shield light. I'm not sure what I'm trying to say, but we can't hide truth. Once the truth emerges, and it'll grow, and this, people talk about needing of transformation of human consciousness. I see people in New Age spirituality, they think, how do we become spiritual and be happy and satisfied in our life? But so many of those people, we want to ignore what's happening on the world situation. How can we just strive for our personal satisfactions and such while these horrendous things are happening around the world. So somehow we, in, you know, appeal to people in New Age thinking, you know, it, spiritual work and spiritual awakening and realization, we all have to become part of this worldwide movement now to bring the truth out into modern society, to break the state of the mass hypnosis of humankind that's been fostered upon us. So I feel now that although I continue along with my writings on mystical and spiritual teachings, that's, to me, a profound element in this whole mix, that we have to awaken people, awaken the human heart among human beings, humankind, to overcome the madness of the mind, the madness that's been fostered in modern times. I would like to recommend to anyone who listens to this show, go on YouTube sometime and listen to the song "Where Is the Love" by Black Eyed Peas. That is a profoundly revolutionary song. If you can't help listen to that song and look at the situation of humankind at this time and be horrified. So I appeal to people out there, listen to this show. Every day we need to be bringing forth truth, and however you might contribute to this movement, we need to gather as forces of light and love around this planet that we're going to overcome this madness of modern times, the deceits and the lies, and bring about a new world. Okay, so today we have a different focus a bit. I have I'm very pleased to have a guest who I'll introduce today, who I see as being one of those soldiers of the New Age out there. And we'll come to that interview in a moment. First, I'll connect in with my regular co-host here. James, how are you?
Oh, hi, Chris. Fine.
Okay. any comments, Jim?
Strange time to be alive.
Isn't it, eh?
Well, isn't it? You know, it's peculiar because, you know, I just was in the bookstore yesterday and I saw that Vincent Bugliosi has a huge, huge, huge book about the Kennedy assassination. Do you know who Vincent Bugliosi is?
No.
He was the district attorney in Los Angeles in the late 60s, early 70s, who wrote a book called Helter Skelter about the Manson murders. And he claimed to have been the one who broke the code as to, you know, what Helter Skelter meant, which was written in blood on the walls. And he wrote a book. And he's quite famous. He's written several books. And he's apparently spent 20 years researching the Kennedy assassination. And so I'm looking at the little write-up on the back of the book, and apparently we can all relax because Vincent has examined it all. And
what? Jim? Did we lose? I'm not sure if I've lost Jim's voice contact there. Connie, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay, I'm not sure we've lost Jim. He was just bringing up this book about the Kennedy assassination. I get this is another thing that's recently emerged, is this deathbed confession of E. Howard Hunt, who's saying that, yeah, there was the conspiracy theories around Kennedy's assassination were never simply theories. It's now clearly evident that the theories had been true, although people didn't fully understand the dynamic of it. I mean, this is just one of the shocking things, and I think the very fact we realize, in a way, there was a coup in the United States with the assassination of Kennedy, one of the most tragic events ever in the history of the United States. And it's like people have allowed that to be covered up for 40 or 50 years, I guess 63. So for so many years, and we live with this, lie of what we say we are as a country, a democratic, freely elected country, and yet the whole time there's this huge deceit and lie perpetrated on the American society. It's the same roots of Kennedy. It's like, I think the Rolling Stones have a song, Symphony for the Devil, and it asks who killed the president and who killed Lenin and who killed these people through time who stand out and speak the truth and have a broader vision of what we need for the human race. Martin Luther King, Gandhi, people of those statures. Okay, so I guess I've lost Jim here. Jim, you're not there? Okay, sorry for the confusion here. Okay, so, well, I'll move along. And today I'm really quite honored to have a guest. Okay, Jim, we're back. Sorry, we lost you there.
Every time I start talking about conspiracy, somebody cuts me off the radio.
really.
We were both cut off. I was cut off, too.
There you go.
I'm back now. As I was trying to ring in, I suddenly, there you were.
Okay. So, Jim, we'll just take it back. You were saying about this fellow at the end of his book.
What did he say? No, just at the back of his book, it says on this massive tome that he's investigated all the conspiracy theories and that Oswald acted alone and killed Kennedy I don't have to read this book. I mean, I know that's complete and utter lunacy. There aren't many things I know in life, but one thing I know for sure is that Lee Harvey Oswald did not kill John Kennedy by himself.
Yeah.
And you know, there's probably 500, 1,000 books out there which have examined the Kennedy assassination, and there's all sorts of people who don't believe in the truth of it. In fact,
yeah.
The majority of the American people don't believe that Lee Harvey Oswald killed Kennedy by himself. And yet, you know, even though that truth is out there, it only goes so far because there's so many sources of disinformation that the information is always obscured and distorted and deviated. So it's very hard in a way when you're challenging the institutional lies, like you were saying about the Internet. I think the Internet's very important. But at the same time, all the established publishing houses have books out questioning 9/11. Like, there's all sorts of excellent books out there published by the mainstream media, but they don't have any impact because people still kind of cling to the assumptive framework that's put out there as the main party line as to what happened. So it's kind of an uphill battle. I mean that applies to a variety of political.
It really does, because the truth is out there. I mean, the truth is out there. It's just no one can deal with the immensity of the problem and what it all means. It's just so overwhelming. Okay, so, I did think the revelation of the E. Howard Hunt tapes. I've heard it twice now on Coast to Coast and in another room on Pal Talk, where I often go into Pal Talk rooms where there's discussion. Excellent room in Pal Talk at www.paltalk.com, and it's a 9/11 was an inside job room, and there's some good rooms in Pal Talk for people who want to be informed about these types of issues. Okay, so anyway, I would like to move along, and I started to introduce our guest while you were away, Jim, and
sure.
I thought I'd try to pick up, but we'll shift focus, and my guest today is Connie Fogel, and Connie is the director, the leader of the Canadian Action Party, and I would say, from my knowledge of Canadian politics, is the only political entity or party in Canada willing, I think, to face the truth of things in our society and to work towards bringing about a new world. I think the Canadian Action Party, not that they claim to have all the parties, but they're willing to face the truth and follow that where it may to bring about the restoration of democracy and justice and egalitarianism within our society. And when I learned all these horrors of 9/11, all these other things, I felt so despairing. And then I found the Canadian Action Party. So for people in the movement wanting to bring truth forward, this is I think, a vehicle for us in Canada to rally around this party, and I hope this is coming. And we're going to meet Connie today. Connie, I'd like to hear about the party. I'd like to hear about Paul Hellyer, who I'm familiar with some of his earlier statements and commentary, and I'd like to have some discussions of the monetary system, the North American Union, and and thank you very much for Connie for honoring us and coming today.
Well, thank you very much for including me. It's so important to share information, and the oppression of the people is precisely because the mainstream media is in sync with the globalizers who want a new way of living, which is a reign for them, a rule for them, and the masses of people of the world are to be the slaves, and we're absolutely dispensable, as a matter of fact, if we can't serve their interests. And so it's very difficult, very hard for an alternate voice, voices like yourself, that are trying to express other ways of thinking. For you, you have an outlet because you're in the media, you're in the alternate media, but the small parties like the Canadian Action Party, we are totally dependent on alternate media to be able to get our information out to people, get our voice heard, so that citizens can realize there are some choices for them, that they don't need to feel paralyzed politically, they don't need to feel isolated, they don't need to feel alienated, they don't need to feel despair. And I think that, well, it's so much to say. Let me just start, I guess, by telling you that the Canadian Action Party began in 1997 under the leadership and direction of Paul Hellyer, who was a former Deputy Prime Minister of Canada, who always...
Under who was he the deputy
before? With the Liberals. With the Liberals.
But under who was...
I think it was Pearson.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yes,
yeah.
Right? And he was also in the Conservative Party. He moved around trying to find an expression of what his views were, but primarily his work was within the Liberal Party. And he resigned when he was a cabinet minister under housing, when what he thought needed to be done for housing for the people of Canada didn't happen, and he just felt he couldn't be there anymore. So he was a man of principle. But primarily, he also was very aware, even through all his years when he was in Parliament, that there was something wrong with our monetary system, and that the powers that we have legally under our own statutes in Canada that puts the power and the sovereignty of money into the hands of the people existed in what we call our Bank of Canada, and that was, you know, being increasingly less used, so that now at this point of time it's used only for about 3 to 5% of the needs of our monetary system in Canada, and the treasure of the Bank of Canada is that it can put the necessary money into the economy free of interest, and it's the interest that's a large part of what is destroying us. And the very fact that it isn't used and has been used less and less since the mid-70s, we never used it for more than about 25% of the needs of the economy. We could have used it for much more. It had the capacity for that. But it's down so low now, and that's precisely because the international financial leadership of the world, which is the core and the source of all the problems in the world, of course, they want to have the control and the domination of the earth's sovereignty over money. And they don't want banks like central banks that have the capacity to keep the sovereignty in the hands of the people. They don't want that. It's the same principle of everything about globalization, that is to take the sovereignty away from the people, just absolutely starve them of their entitlements as human beings. And then all of that ties into what you opened your program in talking about, which is the whole point of consciousness raising, which is something that Paul Hellyer is very much, I think, in tune with and in sync with, and certainly I think I am, and recognizing that there is in fact a significant awareness happening, consciousness raising that is going on in the midst of all the horrors that are here on Earth. There is, I think, a real war, a battle going on between the unconsciousness and the consciousness. The unconsciousness, which is to destroy us, and the consciousness, which is to free us. And that all of the things that you talk about, I think, are beginning to percolate into the, without even people realizing that it's coming into their wavelengths. And when they're beginning to ask and talk about having power amongst themselves and learning that that does reside within themselves. So I'll stop for a minute.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's beyond anything I could have conceived of before. I could never have imagined a group being so systematically deceiving and such through history while the human race has been so unaware of what has happened. I mean, it's shocking. It's horrifying. And we do need to try to be brave of heart in this and abide in the truth that's coming out. And it is a growing worldwide movement. I mean, I heard on the CBC radio one day, they said 10.5 million people had downloaded Loose Change off the Internet. 10.5 million people. This was last August. You know, Virgin Airlines was going to show Loose Change, the new edition, on their flights until they had to back down.
Oh,
but it's coming into movie theaters this year. So these are huge, huge things. And in a way, it's funny because as the truth comes out, you see the lies more and more. Like, I turn on the news now, and it's so phony. I can just see through the people, the deception involved.
Yeah, well, I think
you know how they want to portray Chavez as some kind of deadly vision, deadly person or enemy, because Chavez has seen this power block and wants to be separate from it and not be part, you know, support American currency and so on.
Right.
So it's finances, it's international finances.
It all goes back to money. It does.
And it's unbelievable how the banks have accumulated the wealth of humankind while people live in with such struggle and poverty and famine and things like this. And the banks kind of, it's like Uncle Scrooge has accumulated the wealth of humankind.
That's true. And of course, our political party, the Canadian Action Party, that whole concept of the sovereignty of money, the its connection to humanity, basically, is something we deal about. We deal with the imprisonment of mankind by debt. That is a core to our whole way of functioning. It's a core policy for us, and a lot of very interesting material is on our website to help people to learn the simplicity of money. It's a science, a hidden science that's withheld from people, particularly, specifically and deliberately to keep them imprisoned because of their lack of knowledge of the power of money and the simplicity of money, of our control and our sovereignty if we choose to use it. We in Canada are very lucky because we have this Bank of Canada. Other nations do not have it. The United States has their Federal Reserve, which is
the
not
Federal
a Federal
Reserve.
It's not a federal bank, and it does not have reserves. And the International Monetary Fund, as a matter of fact, part of the globalization process, has gone into countries and demanded that they get rid of their any central banks that had the kind of power that our bank has as conditions for them to get money. The International Monetary Fund and the World Bank have been mechanisms to impoverish the world, and Venezuela is one of the ones that's saying, we're just not going to buy into that crap. We don't need it. It doesn't have to be. You know, in Canada, in some ways in Canada, we're worse off from an industrialized world perspective in that the leadership in this country have deceived us much more sharply than happens in other places. I'm thinking, for instance, of our we have four political parties that are in power, and none of them will talk about the Bank of Canada and its power. None of them will talk about what's really happening with the North American Union. The NDP has begun to make a few very weak sounds. They're just, but really, it's in the area of. Well, we want to know what's going on, and we want there to be some negotiations, and civil society should be included. And no, civil society is not the policy-making side. Civil society puts out information, like organizations like the Council of Canadians, or various labor groups, or the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, or various environmental groups. The leadership, the rulemaking, comes from political parties. Unless you happen to think that democracy run by the people, of the people, and for the people, is not what you want, unless you really want an elite plutocracy of segments of society that sit up there and decide what's good for the rest of us, which is what civil society, in effect, is saying, because they're unaccountable and they're unelected. They're not representative of us. We can't tell them we don't want them to say X, Y, or Z. We can't get rid of them. They're just the same. They're no different in that sense from industry, the financial, military, industrial elite, the Canadian Council of Chief Executives, who are driving the North American Union. The Council of Canadians is only unhappy because they're not sitting on stage on the shoulders with these guys talking about the shaping. That's a bad thing that's happening in terms of understanding the process. I think I see it clearly, and I think I see it clearly precisely because I am looking for an inner guidance. And I think that all of us have that. All of us have that capacity, and we have failed our own selves by not tuning in to that inner guidance the way we need to do.
Well, I mean, we've trusted our politicians when really they've deceived us. We believe that we've lived in a democratic country, but we've not really understand that there's what Hellyer called a permanent government underlying the government. And the elected officials come and go, but that's not where the effective power and strategizing is coming from.
Well,
so in a way,
except that the elected governments are supposed to keep that shadow government, that permanent government, at bay. And there have been times throughout history when the elected government has done a good job and has said, hang on, you guys, we're going to attend to the interests of the people. We're not going to do just what you tell us to do. That permanent government has never gone away. They've always been around. The monopolistic oligarchical system of monarchical, if you even want to say, where a feudalism even, that has never gone away. But from time to time in history, social orders have put together a kind of a structure to govern themselves and put leaders in there who are responsive to them, who have said no to that permanent government. And we happen to be in a time where our leaders are no longer saying no. They're submitting completely.
Exactly.
That's the problem.
Like Kennedy was the last American president, I think, to say no to them on different counts. And that didn't... Exactly.
But you see, we can't... Those kind of... And Martin Luther King... Eisenhower warned a long time ago of the very things that are happening right now. The fact that someone who's... You look at all the leaders in history who have been killed because of the position that they've taken. But another leader does come along to replace them. It's just that we're very short on them right now. There's no question. But we mustn't despair or be fearful to say, well, gee, we don't dare confront these guys or say no, because look what they do to people. They assassinate them. Yes, assassinations are happening all over the place. But you don't quit. That's why you used the word, I think, at the beginning of your program about courage. I think you used that. People have to be strong, and they have to be courageous. And leaders have to be strong, and they have to be courageous. And they're not real leaders if they're not. And so leadership isn't just somebody that's ahead of a party. Leadership is every individual being courageous in their sphere and being strong and being honest and thinking and articulating the truth as they're coming to learn it, and not being afraid of their neighbor or their parent or their brother or their sister or their best friend, not being afraid of being ridiculed. And at the level where people are at risk because they're in decision making, of course those people from time to time will be at risk at being eliminated. That exists, but you don't run and hide because that exists. You confront it head on.
Yeah, we need to, and the more it comes out into public awareness. I mean, often I look at all the people involved, say, for instance, in the media. And, like, do all these people, do they realize in a way their complicity in the cover-up of mass murder and their complicity in the propaganda of this neo-fascist agenda? Like, do they realize that? Do they go home or do they close their eyes to it? What is that quote someone says, like, evil things happen because, like, people close their eyes to it or because no one says anything? Does any Jim or Connie well, know the quote?
It's something like, it's not because of what bad men do, but what good men fail to do, I think.
Good men fail to do.
Right.
Yeah,
exactly.
It was quoted by Edward Kennedy at Robert Kennedy's funeral, I believe. I'm not sure where the quote comes from, but I think that's the essence of it. It's not just what bad people do, it's what good people don't do.
Fail to do, yeah.
Good people are ruled by evil men when good people fail to something when they fail to act or think or
act
in their own interest.
I
know the quote you're referring to. I wish I had it perfect in my mind. It's an excellent quote.
I was just going to ask you. Maybe Connie, I noticed on the website that they have a reference to John Perkins' book, The Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Maybe she could talk a little bit about that, the book and what he describes.
Right, that's very good. As a matter of fact, someone just sent me, an Earl where that takes us to a speech by him where he's talking. It's very excellent. I think we're going to put that up on our website as well. But basically, he's a person who worked within the ruling system of the world. I mean, he worked in a corporation, one of the major corporations of the world, and his job was with the International Monetary Fund to go in and to countries and basically talk the leaders of those countries into submitting to the demands of the International Monetary Fund, and basically in so doing to harm their own people, to steal from their own people. And the people like him, they call themselves the hitmen, the economic hitmen. He talks about it, he calls himself confessing now because he finally acknowledged to himself that what he was doing was absolutely wrong and immoral, and now he wants to make amends and explain to the world that process.
Good.
You know, and he clearly just really documents so well the exploitation, not just the exploitation, but the absolute rape of countries and of nations by the international corporate system, and he documents so well that this is a process that is harmful to humanity and is only good. Some people, a few people, make a lot of money. He made a lot of money. The corporations make a lot of money. Anybody who works in those systems make a lot of money. In the whole new world order, there will always be some people who work within who are going to be very well off, but then the large, large numbers, more and more people, are going to be worse and worse off. The middle class is disappearing in the parts of the world where the middle class has done very well. And that's all deliberate. So it's a book that people should read. It's an easy read. It's not difficult to understand what he's talking about. It reads quickly, and it's very satisfying. And for all people who have a lot of knowledge, a lot of sense of a lot of things, you read that book, and it puts everything together so very, very well. It's kind of like a primer that everybody should be on everybody's reading list. And I was glad finally that somebody gave it to me. I knew about it. It's hard to have enough time to read all the things, but when you're a really busy person and trying to read different things, that's one that should be a first on your list. There's no question.
Yeah, he was on Coast to Coast recently too. It was an excellent interview.
Mm-hmm.
A shocking book. Sorry, Jim.
I really agree with you. That was a lovely description by Connie. Just of, it's an easy read, but it's an essential read, and it's he really details exactly kind of the myth that globalization and capitalism are spreading good works throughout the third world. I mean, what a crock, you know. Basically, what they're doing is they create these phony projects, and then they have them bankrolled by the IMF and by the World Bank, and then all of a sudden the projections don't turn out, and these countries are up to their ears in debt, and they
forever
can't get out of debt.
Forever.
Yeah.
And they know that that's what's going to happen, and that's the hitmen know that's going to happen, and that's the very point.
Yeah.
They deliberately, specifically want to impoverish them so that the resources of those nations can be just stolen forever. I mean, it comes down to the point of nations, for instance, right now, who can't even get water. People are dying because they can't go. If you can imagine it, that we've reached a point in time where corporations have managed to gain control of water supply, and people don't have the money to pay for it, they die. That's happening in parts of the third world, and that's just unconscionable. Next thing they'll be doing is somehow managing to take control of the air we breathe, and maybe this whole carbon dioxide tax, is part of that way of taking control of the air we breathe. Because after all, human beings all emit carbon dioxide, and are we going to be taxed for the amount of hours in the day that we breathe carbon dioxide? Don't laugh.
That's not
so far fetched in terms of what these guys do.
Oh, it's not far-fetched. Nothing is beyond them. Like, I think, to me, the most horrifying thing is their systematic spraying of people with chemtrails.
Uh-huh.
Research in the States has shown that chemtrails contain aluminum fibers, heavy metals, carcinogens, pharmaceuticals, and other noxious agents. There's a newer report there's even tainted blood cells in chemtrails. So, like, we are systematically sprayed by chemtrails. And then there's all these new weaponry, which is destroying the ionosphere, and where they bounce the rays off the ionosphere, and it heats the ionosphere up to the temperature close to that of the sun. Okay, now, do people ever think that, well, maybe global warming may have to do with all these deviant weapons and research, atmospheric research projects that they're undertaking? Like, people, if we're concerned about our environment, it's like they have a new way of hypnotizing the human race that is just carbon dioxide emissions.
Well,
my son at university said his science teacher had a class on that, explained that human beings only emit 4% of the carbon dioxide on the planet,
mm-hmm.
and that the whole thing is a crock. It's to deflect our attention from the more serious problems.
Well, there are.
That's how I see it.
There are so many activities that humankind is doing under the leadership of the people who are in power. Destroying the environment, there's no question about that, and including the kinds of materials that are being put up into the stratosphere, and some talk of the chemtrails being a way of putting something in the atmosphere in order to deal with the hole in the what's that part of the
ionosphere?
There's a hole.
Oh, the ozone layer.
In the ozone layer.
Yeah.
Then you can look at depleted uranium that's dumped into the world. There's no wall up that prevents it from getting into the air and coming over here. Coming into other, and there have been studies done in various places from time to, I think England, there was a study done a few years ago talking about the amount of depleted uranium that was in the air that floated over to there from the war in Afghanistan or Iraq. But of course the masses, that a lot of that information isn't published significantly or often or long enough, because if it were, everybody would say, if for no other reason, just stop those wars so that the air isn't being poisoned, the water isn't being poisoned, the ground isn't being poisoned, the earth isn't being destroyed.
Yeah, and they have much more in store for us, because, I mean, I think the possibility of major attacks against Iran are definitely there, and I think they're likely to use nuclear weapons. I think they want to break through that like limit. Like no one's used nuclear weapons since Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I think they want to break that.
Well, the fact is, nuclear weapons have been using that. All the weapons that they're
right.
using in Afghanistan and Iraq, those are nuclear weapons. They're just smaller ones. They're cluster bombs. That's the problem, and not enough has been made of that. But the reality is, you and I aren't doing it, but the people that are committing those wars, that are doing those attacks, are using using nuclear weapons and despoiling the earth. So
yeah.
when you started
your
program at the beginning, talking about consciousness and talking about the heart, all of this is related. Instead of people, I'm hoping, and it seems to be the case, that more and more people, maybe they don't, the fact that some information like Loose Change is available and people can access that, because they're not going to get it in the mainstream media, since the mainstream media is the concentration of power is in such a few hands, which hands are part of the corporate elite, you know, that's wanting this power all in their hands. More and more people are getting that an awareness as a result of more information that's coming from these alternate sources. And without us understanding exactly why, suddenly the information is spreading. It's just like a video that I did.
Yes.
And it's all of a sudden people are picking up on that, and it's showing up on all sorts of on websites. It's like suddenly there's an awakening, a connectivity. I mean, I've been hearing these things for a while, quite some time. I've been producing stuff for quite some time, but suddenly it's just like taking off. And it's like the whole 9/11 truth movement. And I can only, for me, I see a lot of hope there. And I, whatever the source is, whatever the assistance is, whatever is bringing the connectivity together, it's a very positive something. And everybody has every reason to feel optimistic about the future.
Yeah, it's funny. I think I notice changes in the media. Like, I watch CBC, News World, and I watch CNN a lot. And you, at times you see bits coming out more and more. Like, they're preparing us for new shifts. For example, like, how much they hide the impeach Bush movement. But now that's starting, they're allowing that to start to come out more. And all these shocking revelations about the lies that sent the Americans to the war in Iraq. Like, that's all come out now. So they know now, oh, yeah, they were lied to. They were lied to. People just can't comprehend it and what it all means about what's been done.
Well, this is a very
hopeful
thing.
It's horrified them.
Yeah, it is a very hopeful thing, because if you think of the time of Hitler's time, the deception, the lies to the people were comparable. And they managed to go for quite a number of years with those lies. And I was so concerned when, right after the 9/11 incident and the putting onto us the Patriot Act in the States and our comparable acts in Canada, I was so afraid that we were on our way to the end. But it seems that suppression of truth is not surviving the same way it did in that period of time in Hitler's time. It was a five-year period there. So I'm really optimistic and hopeful that the truth it always was powerful, but the truth being able to be felt and to be understood is seems to be happening in a stronger kind of way right now.
Yeah, the truth will set us free. It literally will set us free of the tyranny of these elites. I believe this is what is to happen as the truth comes out into the world.
Well, can I present an alternative interpretation?
Sure, then, please.
I mean, you know, in a sense, I think there's a lot of truth in what you're saying. But, you know, having been a more political person for 40 years, I mean, I just reflect on what happened in Vietnam and the lies that the government told about the Vietnam War and everything that was happening in the 60s. And since then, there's been 5,000 books written about the lies of Vietnam, and there's been all sorts of exposure of the lies. And it didn't stop the Americans from going into Iraq the first time. And the lies of the first Iraqi war didn't stop them from going in the second time.
You're right.
Well, I mean, it seems to me that there's always going to be a segment of the population that is informed. There's always going to be a segment of the population that believes anything that the government says. And in between, there's this vast number of people who don't really know what to believe and tend to want to, I think, be a little bit more conservative and trust their government and go along with the official story.
Yeah.
And the one thing I see, like, Lyndon Johnson decided to retire and not seek a second term when Walter Cronkite publicly on CBS News, you know, questioned whether or not the war was winnable. And his line was, once he'd lost Cronkite, he knew he'd lost middle America. He'd lost that huge, you know, segment of the population that he had to have behind him. And in a way, like, I guess one thing is with the Internet is that the Internet is international. It collapses all borders. It collapses all divisions. And in a sense, I think that's the one encouraging thing. Like, the internet's really subversive, you know, and don't think that they're not going to try to control that.
Well, they have. They are.
And they already
they are. Yeah, but at the same time, it's an incredibly powerful vehicle, because, like, Loose Change is a perfect example. It's like this little film that was made by, you know, for nothing by a bunch of kids, eh?
Yeah.
And it's had such a profound impact. And so,
yeah,
you know, on the other hand, you have, like, last week, Bill Moyers, who used to be Lyndon Johnson's press secretary and is a broadcaster that does a lot of shows on PBS in the States, had a whole program, an hour and a half, examining the lies that led up to the second Iraq War and the media's complicity. But this was supposed to be an exposure and an examination, and it was just the biggest fluff piece I've ever seen in my life, because it came nowhere near dealing with the real essential truth of the whole thing. So even the exposure isn't really an exposure. It's a reinforcement of the assumptive framework on which everything is based in the first place. You know, like, I just thought it was absolutely pathetic in terms of,
yeah.
For instance, Bob Simon, who's on 60 Minutes and who was based in the Middle East, was quoted as saying, well, we in the journalists in the Middle East, we knew there was no connection between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, but inside the Beltway, like within Washington, journalists are too close to things, and so they were willing to kind of buy the Bush rhetoric and the Bush explanation. But that's absolutely ridiculous. Like, I live in Toronto. I'm not an expert on international affairs, but I knew there was no connection between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. I mean, anybody who opens a book would know that, who has read anything about either of them. So, I mean, it's completely not only erroneous, but it's completely deceptive to suggest that, oh, somehow, you know, that this was some great mystery. It's not a mystery at all. It's that the press went along with this thing 100% and promoted it.
But I think you've hit the nail on the head, though, politically, of what we're facing right now, in the sense that, though probably a large number, maybe even a majority of people are in the same wavelength as you are, yet we're powerless. The same stuff keeps happening, and it's because the people who are in the leadership positions, who are in the positions of power, have no accountability to us. We have no control over them. And that is what I see as a big change that's happening. And this is why in Canada, you know, people, massive numbers of people are not voting, or if they do vote, we keep ending up with a minority government, because people are not satisfied with the leadership that's there. They know that it's not right. They know that it's not accountable to them. They know that it's not serving them. They know that it's deceiving them. And so this is what my focus is as a political party, is to say to people, we don't have to live under the kind of a regime that they're giving us. We can rearrange how we live, so that we put the power back in the hands of the people, so the larger number of us who say, we understand this is all crap, and we're not going to live with it, we're not going to be ruled by it, we're not going to have all the changes happen in our system as a result of those lies. And I'm confident that is a message that's permeating as a result of the internet, where people are just not accepting the way that things have been going, and they're acknowledging that there has to be a different way, and that is, what is a different way? Well, a different way is a structure that gives people the power to remove those who are sitting there, those that we put in Parliament. Let's just talk just about Canada. Some form of recall has to be brought in, forms of a referendum kind of government, as the Swiss model, where on every major issue, if the government wants to do something and a citizen says, no, I don't want that, and they can call for a referendum, and it has to go to referendum, and then the decision is binding. There was a time when I didn't like that system. I thought, well, we would be ruled by the minority. But I'm absolutely convinced now that it's the only form, because of the reality of the failure of the system the way it is now, with all the power in the hands of an elite few who just thumb their nose at us and laugh.
Yeah, like Machiavelli said, power corrupts absolute. Power corrupts absolutely.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's on a level, a kind of a global level, which is really quite horrendous.
Well, I feel good and I feel hopeful. I understand all the bad stuff, and I know all the things that we're talking about that exist. But I just I want it to be a good future, and I really feel inside my heart that it will be a good future. We are in a turning point, and we either go to that heart that you were talking about and develop that part of our humanity to its fullest and use it. The turning point is that we either do that now and take upon ourselves and unto ourselves the control that I'm talking about, which is possible, or else we will not survive this time. I think we truly are. The Earth is at a point where humanity is going to destroy itself, or humanity is going to save itself, and it depends on you me and the little people saying to the guys that are running it, "No more. You're not doing that anymore. We're taking over."
Yeah. I like to think of this as the Third World War.
It
is where we say no, no. Okay, you guys gotta have a holiday in Cuba. New pet dogs. Okay, give the human race an opportunity to move ahead into a future.
Right.
You know, who wants to live in a police state? These people have encultured this culture of terrorism and fearfulness among people. It's so insane.
Right.
And they multiplied all their own security forces and devious ways of control. It's so unnecessary. It's such a waste of human life, of money.
A lot of people ought to live in police states, so that's a problem. You know, keep them dope with religion and sex and TV, and you think you're so clever and classless and free, but you're still effing the peasants as far as I can. Working class.
That's Bob Dylan?
John Lennon.
Working
class hero. I mean,
people are
mollified by shiny objects. They're like, you know, they're hypnotized by Entertainment Tonight and iPods and all that crap that you know, the technological gadgets and marvels and the system produces. And I think people are quite happy to live in a police state. You know, so just don't bother me. Like. That's the problem.
Yeah, as long as it doesn't affect me now.
Yeah, as long as it doesn't affect me. And that's what you
that's
see.
That's what I see.
Well,
that's
guys,
terrible.
I have
that's
to go. It's 2 o'clock and I have to be someplace else.
Okay, I'm sorry.
And I really I appreciate having the opportunity to be on the show with you. And keep up the good work.
It was a pleasure to have you here, and I hope we can get you back.
Good, another time.
And you or other, you know, other people from your party who might be running in some area who would like
right.
to represent
Well, we'll have their
themselves.
Names up on the website, and you'll be able to connect them with their contacts right there directly. Okay?
Great.
Sounds
okay,
good.
Okay, thank you very
thank
much,
you,
Connie.
Great, right. Bye-bye.
Okay, goodbye. Yeah, Jim.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Connie's
well, that
Vancouver,
was nice.
Is she in Vancouver
yeah.
to take it?
Yeah.
She's on the West Coast? Yeah.
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 Yeah. Wow. A Canadian party that it wants to. One of their main focuses is the North American Union. Like this, I don't know if you know much about that, but that's kind of being slipped by people. I mean, it's coming out more.
That's a question for maybe she'll come on again, because I'm sure she has some interesting things to say about water, because that's you know Canada's. The United States' main interest in Canada economically is in terms of controlling its resources. And the most precious resource, I mean, she alluded to it, in the 21st century is going to be fresh
water.
Guess what we have lots of, and guess what the United States doesn't have lots of.
Guess what? The North American Union essentially takes the sovereignty, the ownership of Canadian natural resources out of the hands of the sovereignty of Canada and puts it to the benefit of this elite. That's what it does. So they can write all the laws that govern the control of those resources. That's what it does.
That was already seated in 1989 in NAFTA, in the North American Free Trade Agreement by Canada.
Exactly.
Canada gave up the right to its resources and control of its resources, and essentially that's the most important part of that is water. As I say, if you look at the American population, most of the areas where the population is growing most rapidly are west of the Mississippi River. Well, there's only one problem with that. West of the Mississippi River, not a great deal of water, and there's not a great deal of fresh water. And, you know, in the southwest, you have that's where the population is growing fastest. Well, it's desert. It's essentially, there's a huge demand for water there, and eventually the United States is going to need Canadian water. I mean, it needs it now, realistically, but and that's that's what NAFTA is about.
It's an interesting question, kind of. Like, I mean, I feel also like the, in a way the water belongs to humanity in a way, too. I see that, too.
Well,
like,
if they want to pay
for it,
sure.
Well, exactly. As other resources, it's a trade commodity.
Well,
I mean,
But by the same token, you know, under globalization, you know, the corporations go into Bolivia and try to privatize the water supply in Bolivia. I mean, that they want to, you know, make people pay for water, peasants. And I mean, there was a huge uproar and uprising against that in Bolivia because, you know, people have a fundamental right to water. I mean, you know, you have to have water to stay alive, to grow crops, you know. I mean, it's just, it's a fundamental necessity. Unfortunately, that's the world we live in. Is like when she was talking about, Connie was talking about taxing the air we breathe. Well, it's probably just a matter of time before some genius comes up with a scheme to, you know, make a buck on that too. Like, I wouldn't put anything past the people who control the economy. You know, like, not a very good group.
It was very interesting. So that was just Connie Fogel for listeners, and that's a Canadian Action Party, and they have a website at www.canadianactionparty.ca. And I hope people with contacts in Canada, people need to network in this alternate movement. We need to be networking and work together. 9/11 truthers should contact Canadian Action Party and work together in that we share similar concerns, you know, and peace groups, environmental groups. Like, we need to be making contact into different networks of community groups to kind of, you know, I do think that we need, it's like Connie was hopeful, and I'm, you know, at times I'm quite distressed by it all because I see the horror of what's being done daily now around the world, the kind of awful things. But at the same time, there is those signs of hope, and I think people are beginning to wake up more, and even the media is becoming more aware of their complicity in these things. You know, a lot of people are subject to Nuremberg charges. You know, you can't just say all the time, oh, we're just doing what we're told, or we're just doing our job, you know. What are you doing your job, you know? Selling out your nation, your family, your environment, your world, you know, for what? So you have fancy white teeth and nice cars and lots of money in the bank, you know? I mean, I see these people, creatures over in the financial district of England who got Christmas bonuses of $120 million, kind of, I saw, and just... And I look at that, and I look at, oh, yeah, how much money did they have left for the 9/11 workers who are kind of dying of lung cancer, you know? Where was the money for them, you know? It's just such how the wealth of humankind has been so taken over by small groups of elite and in really criminal and devious ways. You know, and somehow we need to all work together to kind of undo this. And, you know, I'm sympathetic to people on the wrong side at times, too. They get caught up in things, and they're goats. I see sheep and goats. The mass of the public are sheep. They just go along. They do what they're told, and they're titillated by the TV and money, sex, and power and relationships and so on. They're the sheep. They just go along, and they go to church once a week, and everybody praises God. But meanwhile, the government is mass murdering people and all these devious things throughout their society. But they think they're Christians, and that's what they do. And where have the churches been? Where have the churches been? You know, it's unbelievable. It shows like Gurdjieff said, if you want to lose your faith in religion, make friends with the priest. You know.
Yeah.
If you want to lose your faith in Christianity, look at what the churches have done to bring truth into the world. You know, it's terrible.
Yeah.
A lot of people are complicit in so many ways, and they don't mean to be. It's just the whole scheme is so horrendous. Nobody grasps that's what the whole of it is and what they've become involved in, you know. But I do, you know, I very much feel between now and 2012 is going to be a huge transitional time on the world. You know, I feel the evidence is for 9/11. They shot themselves in the foot. That's how I feel, because the evidence is there for what that was, can wake humankind up to realize how they've been deceived. And then it unfolds, and then you just begin to see it. And it's like you see the truth in everything, and you see all the lies. You see it all. You know, and then you can't, the more and more that happens, you can't go back. You know truth.
Yeah, but
you know, you can't.
Maybe you do, but I'm not, when you say you see the truth, I'm not sure most people really would go beyond, even if, you know, that was proven to them or that they came to accept that. It's like, you know, it's the same as like with the Kennedy assassination. Like I say, most Americans don't believe that John Kennedy was assassinated by Lee Harvey Oswald. Consistently polls show that. Like the polls show that more than 50% of New Yorkers don't believe the official story of 9/11. But what difference does it make? I mean, they're still going to go out and vote for George Bush or what other moron that, you know, Republicans or the Democrats put up. I mean, you know,
yeah.
it doesn't really translate. I think, you know, I mean, I'm much more cynical and skeptical than you are in
yes.
terms of like just because. Well, I you know, I was pretty political in the '60s and mm-hmm. you know, Vietnam and everything, and I just see kind of like how nothing really changes. I take much more the view of, like of Gurdjieff. I think I'll go back to that great quote from Uspensky and. In Search of the Miraculous, you know, at the beginning of the First World War, when he sees the truck loaded with crutches drive by, and it's before the war has started, and he's just struck by this lorry load of crutches, you know, which, as he says, are for legs which are not yet blown off, and you know, not yet injured. It just sort of, in the crutches, he sees all the lies with which people deceive themselves. Because, as he said,
yeah.
he could feel
yeah.
the whole momentum of things coming to this point where there was going to be this war to end all wars, you know? I mean,
yeah, no one could do anything. Everyone
and nobody
was
could
help
get, it was yeah. just sort of inevitable. And just sort of like on some level, I that's what I see in terms of my own understanding from an esoteric viewpoint is that I see how everything happens, and you know that, you know, as an individual, your duty is to try to be as conscious as possible, and it is to try to, you know, to be aware and to try to be, you know, a vehicle for the forces of light and goodness. But in another sense too, like you're swimming against the current, I mean, in a sense, like, you know, you have a responsibility not to go along with the lies, but in another sense, too, like, you know, you have to kind of be aware of the reality of the situation. Like, I just see it's like, I mean, there's such complex forces that shape the world that we're in, and most people are so deceived as to what they are that I'm not really even sure that the truth shall set you free. Hope so. Hope you're right, but I, you know, I'm very skeptical
yeah.
that's going to be the case, you know. I mean, it's
yeah.
In a way too, like there's just so many different examples of so many horrific things, like on the 5th anniversary of September 11th, I sent out an email to people and I said, you know, while we're sort of reflecting and we're going to have all this stuff in the media about the 5th anniversary of 9/11, in the meantime, 50 million people in the world starved to death, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's
yeah.
the reality. It's actually more than that. It's probably closer to 60 million people. You know,
yeah.
we know that. We all know that. Everybody knows that there are millions of people starve to death, you know, every year, like tens of millions of people starve to death every year. But does that really
yeah.
result
yeah.
in any kind of meaningful change? Not really. And then guys are giving themselves $120 million bonuses. I mean, you
yeah.
know,
yeah.
it's enough to make you just, like, you know, want to walk off the end of the dock and not come up to the surface, you know. Like, it's just really...
Yeah.
It's very, it's like, again, like Gurdjieff says, sort of it's the horror of the situation, you know. If we could
yeah.
really understand the horror of it all, you know, we couldn't help but be appalled by, but we compartmentalize and we rationalize and you know, we say, it took, that's too
yeah.
bad, and, you know, but we, you
yeah,
know.
People have minds like sieves, like it's like they
yeah.
you kind of fill their mind, but they can't remember what they heard 5 minutes before, so everything
yeah.
just kind of passes through them. It's like they can't kind of grasp it all together and say, whoa, like, wow, look at this, you know, and realize we have to do something, you know.
Please.
But I do. I'm more hopeful than you. I think it's happening more. I think there's turning even in the media. I think they're gonna be, you know. I think there's major things and.
Well, I don't. I mean, I don't see that at all in turning in the media. I don't see anybody questioning any of the basic assumptions. I mean, there's all sorts of criticism of Bush. I mean, where is he, by the way? You know, he just seems to have disappeared. Eh? Like, there's all sorts of criticism of what's going on with the war and everything. But you know, nobody really kind of questions all the basic assumptions. Like, nobody ever has asked the question, well, what if Saddam Hussein actually did have weapons of mass destruction? What really gives the American government the right to go halfway around the world and attack them? You know, like, I mean. Like, that's my question. It's like, so what, you know? So what if Iran has a nuclear bomb? You got 20,000 of them, you know? Israel's got nuclear bombs. France has got nuclear bombs. China, you know? I mean, well, they're creating...
Yeah, but I mean,
the
answer to it is like, in a way, obvious in ways. Like, one thing is that Saddam wanted to get off the American dollar and not accept American currency for their oil. Okay, and which, see, United States currency is in a very, very kind of inflated and precarious position. And other countries are starting not want American dollars so much. And America's like so trillions and trillions of dollars to China. So there's like really, you know, the financial markets is that aspect. There's the oil aspect. There's the having a military base and presence there, because the Americans, these people want to be the world dominant superpower with weapons of mass destruction around the world that they can intimidate anyone who doesn't want to be part of their imaginary whatever it is, new world order. You know, they want to kind of have control of the lives of humankind. I mean, it's quite remarkable. You see, in the States now, they wanna make it so that you have to have a prescription to get vitamins and health products. See, you do. They're introducing this in the States. You know, it'll kind of suppress it, and then they'll have gained control of it. They want to control every aspect of people's life. It's quite shocking. They wanna, you know, electronic surveillance. They have things I don't even want to go into.
They've already had that. I mean, that's widespread. Like now, I mean. You know, just on these various topics, if anybody doesn't think we're completely crazy, I'm reading Mark Crispin Miller's book, Cruel and Unusual, which the subtitle is Bush/Cheney's New World Order, which I would highly recommend. Very interesting book. He wrote the Bush Dyslexicon, and his interesting... Dyslexicon. He's just talking about how the reviews in the mainstream press of his first book, he was kind of compared to being the left-wing version of Ann Coulter and all these kind of extremists on the right. He was supposed to be the left-wing version, and he was all sorts of things were attributed to him that he never even said in his book, you know. And it was quite funny, like, when he's reviewing the reviews, you know, and you just see how kind of anybody who even kind of questions, you know, even like the fundamental assumptions of things is just, you know, they're put in this category, oh, it's some sort of nut, you know, and just sort of dismissed, you know, by the mainstream press. I mean, worst offenders are the New York Times and the Washington Post, all these quote unquote great newspapers, you know. Nothing great about them, you know. They're completely full of liars and part of the power structure that keeps everything in place, you know.
Yeah.
Still read it, but you know, like, for your
community, it's still informative.
Because,
I mean,
even if
it has their slant on it, and they cherry pick in terms of what they present to you, and you even see what their propaganda is to show you what they want to do next. You know, like I've been able to see over the last month how they want to kind of condition the American psyche so that Americans think now they have to really attack Iran. It was Iran that poses a threat to Americans, so now they have to do Iran. Okay, and you can see that, like on CNN, how they bring up all these little pseudo-expert fraud doctors they got and all these institutes they've set up to kind of, so they draw on their little pseudo-experts and march them out, and they give their propaganda, and they cherry-pick and give twists
you know
to
what
you see.
You know what I find hilarious when they're talking about Iran and Iraq is how, as part of that, what you're talking about is how you get these guys coming on. I mean, I just laugh at these people when I hear them now. These guys come on, they're very sober, and they're saying, well, you know, there's all sorts of infiltration in Iraq by Iranian forces, and that they're behind all these different groups that are part of the insurgency. And I'm thinking, well, who the hell started the war? You know, you guys started it. You know, it wasn't a war. I mean, it's like Bush kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, Iraq is full of terrorists. Well, it actually wasn't until you started the war there, and then now it's full of terrorists for sure. You guys went over there, and now they're attacking you. And of course, when I say you, I mean you're not over there. Cheney's not over there.
The relatives are
over there. It's some poor guy who wants to defend his country and has a job in the military, and he's over there.
She's over there getting shot.
It's awful. I mean, I feel terrible for these people.
It's awful for them.
They're traumatized by it. Yeah, well, do you
and
know?
And many of them get over there and they realize it's wrong and they see the lies of it, you know?
Well, and that's true of every war. I mean, that's one of the things that you very seldom read is that how, you know, there was a wonderful article in the New Yorker a couple of years ago about talking about war and about how, you know, first of all, in Second World War, in the Korean War, in Vietnam, a large percentage of the military and of infantry units, guys won't fire their guns. They can't. When people kill people, it has a pretty devastating impact on them, you know, even though they're in a war and they're allowed to do it and they're supposed to do it and they have to do it to survive.
Yeah, but still traumatizing.
It has a terrible effect on people psychologically, and you never hear that,
yeah.
You know, about the glory, about fighting for your country and everything. Marilyn Young's book on Vietnam, there's this statistic, and I don't know where she got this, but, you know, something like 53,000 Americans died in fighting in Vietnam. She said in her book, and this was written in the mid-'80s, no later than the late-'80s, she said that more American soldiers, ex-servicemen, had killed themselves and died in Vietnam.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I don't know if that statistic is true, but I mean,
to even
contemplate that, I mean,
yeah.
that's the big lie that nobody ever talks about, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, even our generation, our dads who fought in the Second World War, you know,
mm-hmm.
a lot of them didn't want to talk about it. You know, when I was growing up, a lot of the guys who'd been over there, you know, they didn't want to talk about it. We had all their army stuff, and we thought it was glamorous and everything, but, you know, it was pretty horrific. And, I mean, if ever there was a war that needed to be fought, the Second World War would qualify as a quote-unquote good war, but, you know, it's pretty horrific. And, you know, all these people who are so gung-ho on going to war really ought to fight in one before they start doing it, you know, Yeah, I mean, I noticed that Bush and Cheney, they never served, but Colin Powell, who did fight in Vietnam, was the one who was least eager to go to war with Iraq, you know, and I mean, that's generally the case, you know.
Yeah, it's funny how I can't imagine what the lives of all these people are like, knowing all the lies and everything, the whole deceit of the whole thing. It must be very peculiar lives, kind of.
That's a very interesting question. I guess it just kind of goes to the idea how asleep we all are. I mean, I get up every day and think about a whole lives in my life and, you know, all the inadequacies of myself as a human being. I mean, I'm quite aware of many of them, not all of them, obviously, but, you know, I don't go around killing people for a living, you know, it's not easy.
I don't
go around cheating and lying on a regular basis. You know, I lie on a smaller basis.
And stealing money. How about you go around stealing everybody's money? Or
only when they're not looking.
Some cookie oil, do you go over and steal their cookie oil?
Only when they're not looking. I know.
It's funny to think of what's being done. on an international level. Like, think of it in terms of neighborhoods. Like, you know,
how insane
it would be. You know,
yeah.
But on the international level, it's like everyone believes in it because the kind of media and the spins and the lies. Yeah. And
it's kind of like that great essay, that anti-war essay that I've referenced before by Henry Miller, Murder the Murderer. And he says, you know, he's talking about the Second World War and about, you know, how, I mean, he was an anarchist, like not a bomb throwing anarchist, but an anarchist in the sense that he just didn't believe in the government and he didn't believe in the state as you know, being able to provide what an individual really needs. And then he says, you know, that all wars start with the great lie that A, we're being protected against something which is so horrific that, you know, that life is unimaginable, so we have to go and kill these other people. And then eventually when we're done killing them and the war's over, everything's going to be better for everybody. And he said, you know, it's like it's just a huge lie. But he said at one point, he says, you know, the nitwits who haven't shown any capacity whatsoever to govern themselves suddenly feel that it's, you know, it's not only their right but their duty to go somewhere else and impose their, you know, understanding of things on other people and teach them how to govern themselves. And then that's kind of the
tragedy
of it all,
amazing,
you know.
Right?
It's like,
yeah.
You know, like, I mean, not to harp on the American, because they're certainly not the only ones who are guilty of this, but I mean, you know, any nation that elects George Bush governed, you know, as their head of government, really ought to question whether or not they should be going around teaching the rest of the world how to govern themselves, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, the idea that Canada could teach anybody how to govern themselves is completely absurd to me, because we can't govern ourselves. I mean, we got a bunch of nitwits, you know? Like, I mean, that just strikes me as so peculiar that, you know, yeah, you guys really don't know what you're doing. Here, we'll come over and kill a bunch of you, and then we'll teach you how to run your country, you know?
Yeah, it's awful
absurd
to look at human history, and you see how much the intelligence agencies and that have undermined other governments and countries and assassinated leaders and you know, set up tyrants and then allowed that at different points. It's terrible, you know.
Yeah.
Rather than just, well, it's like no one can just like let people be and have regional governments and country structures, you know, like that's good. Like, why can't they just let people be? Why do some people want to have that drive for power, control over people? It's an interesting psychological question. Money, sex, and power, the first
money,
three.
Money, sex, and power, yeah. It's pretty simple,
but George
really.
Bush says, oh, this is the third wave, you know, and it is. It's the third wave. It's the egomaniacs who wanted to rule the world, you know. It is false ego, and you know, they never got to a certain level of awakening of the heart or of the intelligence within themselves. You know,
it reminds me in Gurdjieff's Tales of the Stilts' grandson, how he's talking about the history of humankind, and he starts talking about the Greeks, and he refers to Alexander all the time as that vainglorious Greek, and then he talks about the Romans, and he says that something about that they built this huge empire and they ruled the world, and their main contribution was to humankind was perfecting certain ways of making pasta or something. You know, it's really hilarious, because he kind of just pokes holes in all this, you know, this glorious history, like Alexander the Great Conqueror is basically just an egomaniac, you know, strutting around, and then the Romans, you know, the great Roman civilization perfecting ways of making pasta.
He's so funny in Beelzebub's Tales.
He's
such an unusual perspective on life on planet Earth, because he does it from the perspective Beelzebub is supposed to have been banished to our solar system for having intervened in the kind of management of the world. And he was banished to our solar system, and he was supposed to have lived on Mars and to have visited the Earth six times through his life, beginning with the period of Atlantis and then visiting the planet Earth at six different periods. And it's kind of this cosmic view on the life of humankind and seeing the kind of insanity of mankind. And Gurdjieff talks in there, for instance, about the processes of reciprocal destruction, which is his word for warfare. Yeah, it's a shocking book, Bales Above the Tales. Boy, I see so much more in that now as
yeah.
You know, I'm in terms of understanding the history of the solar system and I have a different understanding now of the possibilities of things like aliens and beings in other dimensions and things.
There's a wonderful part in that book where he talks about the holy labors of the very saintly Ashiata Shamash, who is the spiritual teacher who awakened
individual
consciousness.
Who was actualized from above. He uses
from above,
that phrase.
Yeah,
actualized from above.
Which is fantastic.
Ashiata Shamash.
Ashiata Shamash is, and I think in, I was going to say about his name, but I'm not sure actually that this is right, but I was going to say the idea of him being an incarnation of like a higher spiritual intelligence, and he comes down and he awakens conscience in human beings. But it's very interesting, as one of the commentators on Beelzebub says, like, Ashiata Shamash teaches human beings, but it's interesting, he doesn't teach them directly. He kind of teaches them indirectly and awakens their emotional intelligence and their conscience. And when that happens, war stops, eh? Like, there's no killing. And then along comes one of the Hasnasmas individuals?
Hasnasmas individuals, yeah.
Yeah, who logically begins with the idea that the purpose of human life is for the individual to maximize their own pleasure and profit. So I'm paraphrasing very badly, but it's all kind of egoistic and satisfaction and worldly desires. And so spreads this gospel, and it's kind of like, I think it's a commentary on, it's a commentary on Lenin and Marx and Trotsky, because it refers to kind of the communist movement and the idea that the greatest good of humankind will be realized through this solely material and physical level of satisfaction. And so he undoes the saintly labors of Ashiata Shamash, and therefore people no longer live in accordance with their conscience, and killing starts again, and war starts again. And it kind of shows like the limits of rationality and materialism, that you have to have the wisdom of the heart and of spirituality and of religion in order to fulfill yourself as a human being and live in accordance not just with your mind's dictates, but with conscience and something higher within yourself.
That's exactly what needs to happen, like people terms of the awakening of humankind and kind of waking up and like realize what we've done or allowed to do or been part of and so on, and there's kind of a remorse of conscience in people, and you know, and people start to turn around and like undo. I think so many things could be undone in a natural way.
Well,
much
I think
more than people think, you know.
That's what I see is so valuable in your work in terms of not only investigating the secret teachings of all ages and the mystical and esoteric traditions and what it says about what we are as human beings and what we could become as human beings, but it's extremely useful because you present this in terms of a dialogue with the modern scientific and psychological ideas about who we are and what we are. And in a way, you know, if nobody else understands it, I've certainly gotten a lot out of it, and I find it's quite inspiring just to realize kind of the mystery and the wonder of what we are as human beings and what the nature of our consciousness and our existence and our purpose here on planet Earth is. You know, we grow up and we're filled up with all these ideas about ourselves and about the world, and most of it's just bafflegab. It's just blither, blather, you know.
Accumulated.
Yeah, all the rubbish
of human
mentation. Yeah,
that's
exactly.
That's his phrase. The aim of Beelzebub's tales was to corrode without mercy. All the rubbish accumulated through centuries of human mentation.
Yeah.
I see that in terms of modern science and modern kind of spirituality, some of the pablum spirituality, you know?
Yeah, it's in both modern science and in modern religion and in New Age teachings and alternate spirituality. It's in all of it. I mean, within science, within religion, within alternate spirituality, New Age teachings,
yeah.
there's also a lot of truth, you know. It's just
yeah.
that the problem
yeah,
is
that's right.
everything is so distorted and deviated and on a like the wrong kind of level of understanding and the wrong assumptive framework, you know, that it doesn't make sense and it leads to all sorts of sort of false conclusions. And,
yeah.
Yeah,
or
yeah,
enigmas
exactly.
and questions, things that
yeah.
we don't understand. Like,
yeah.
yeah. Like all the things that can't be explained, all the evidences for all the psychical phenomena and all the evidences for mystical experiences and all the evidences for other paranormal abilities and all the evidences for UFOs, past civilizations and periods of Earth history. Yeah. There's so many enigmas in all aspects
yeah.
of life, really.
What is the nature of I? What is the nature of self? What is the nature of consciousness? What is the nature
yeah,
of consciousness?
Yeah, we haven't...
What,
yeah,
what is
people
the, what
don't
is
even
purpose?
Think have that question even hardly. They
what is our purpose as human beings? You know, is it just to come
yeah.
here over, you know, come into this body and eat and sleep and drink and have sex and then die? I mean, you know, is that it? I mean, I think that... when you look at these ancient teachings and you begin to penetrate them and you begin to realize the reality of what they're saying and the special aura of reality that surrounds them, then you realize that there are very, very deep meanings in these ideas and that, you know, it's a lifetime's work to try to understand them, to try to work with them, to try to refine them and know them within yourself. And by doing so, it changes your understanding of the meaning of everything. And you realize that, you know, much of what comes into you is just so much rubbish, you know, like we're inundated with this garbage, basically. And
yes, it's like we lack the most essential elements. But if
yeah.
you have those, then all the bits kind of fit into a framework or context or something.
Yeah.
Like, that's what I found. Like, I remember when I began to... I studied modern psychology and science all up to a certain point, and then I started reading the Fourth Way teaching. And I got to a point, I thought everything I'd ever read was complete garbage. And
yeah.
Everything in psychology was just all complete garbage. But then it took time, though, a bit. I could come back and see how there was, like, value in all of the bits. But really only if you have the deeper perspective. But
yeah.
if you're only caught up in all the little bits, well, then you're just lost in all these little bits of knowledge and information. You have to understand the deeper principles of creation. And then from that perspective, look at what the little bits are and how they fit into the whole.
Yeah, and I think that's
yeah, certainly.
Critical word you just mentioned is perspective, because it's kind of like what the esoteric and mystical teachings provide is exactly that, is perspective. You can kind of step back and you can see a whole different configuration and patterning of all the different bits, whereas before you were kind of in the flat land of all those bits, and so you couldn't kind of see the connections, and they were all sort of disparate and really isolated in a sense. But if you from a mystical perspective kind of add degrees of dimensionality to things, you can get a more kind of holistic perspective on where everything fits and on what level it fits, you know, and you get a much more comprehensive and integrated viewpoint of things.
It's we can come to an understanding of how there can be multi-dimensional existence. That's what I've realized. Like, I have a sense of that within myself, and it's so consistent with everything else. It all fits together that we are multidimensional beings, and we come into the body, and we're clothed in the body. And when we die, that this life essence persists, and that your energies withdraw into the heart center, and you still maintain existence in subtle dimensions of being, still clothed in other bodies, so you can still think and feel and have continued existence. You still have personal identity. I mean, lots of things are possible beyond death, but people at death may go into swoons and wake up in states of unconsciousness and being lost and things like that, or people can pass down a tunnel into higher spiritual realm. But I believe definitely in multidimensional existence, and that we have the wrong idea of extraterrestrials. In the way I say, we are extraterrestrial, because the inner being is not born of the earth. It is not a thing that is a material made of a material, simply made of material atoms. The inner being is something deeper that's tied into the physics of the heart and the physics of what space is. And the new ideas in science are allowing us to understand these kinds of ideas more and more, how this could be possible. Like the new ideas of holography in physics, just as one example, or the theories about quantum field theories and the interrelatedness of things in terms of quantum theory, how everything is part of a whole, and that everything retains memory of everything, in a sense. So I've wandered a little bit, Jim, for what we're talking about. Oh, yeah, having a mystical perspective, you know, and that's why, like, I come back to those two things, three things in a way in my work, I'd say, of the outstanding things. The first is the idea of the heart doctrine, you know, that is elaborated in all true esoteric teachings, I would maintain. As a scholar, I would maintain that. And that compares with the head doctrine of modern science. And then the second thing is a whole concept of zero-point studies, that we ourselves have an inner life center or element or monad or jiva atma or divine spark or God spark. We ourselves have some entity of some type, however, whatever name we might try to put on it, in the innermost core of our being. So to try to take that idea seriously and then try to understand ourselves and from that perspective, that we, just like the universe grew from a point source, so we might have an individual I at the heart of being, in a sense, and that there is a mysterious inner physics and metaphysics to what a human being is that people have no idea of. Life is so far deeper than people have any idea of in terms of its multidimensional nature and other worlds and so on. And then the third area that I think my work is really quite unique in is trying to emphasize that these ideas that God is first one, then three, and then seven. And that is a pattern of mystical creation. From my study of the esoteric literature, I would say that those principles have to have application in psychology, physics, chemistry, any subject we would want to understand. We need to apply this understanding of the one becoming three and then seven, instead of thinking, as scientists do, all dualistically, that there's only matter and energy, or time and space, or the observer and the observed, or the wave and the particle, or the stimulus and the response, or the good and the bad, all the dualities of modern thinking. So instead, we understand things, this 1-3-7 pattern, and how in my work I've applied that. I applied to psychology, I applied to physics, I applied it to understanding new ideas about higher dimensional space. Because I say we all live in seven-dimensional space, and our monadic essence is in seven-dimensional hyperspace, seven inside, seven outside. So I'm saying there's this whole inner dimensionality and structure to inner existence within ourselves as living beings. So it's a profound, so there's those kind of three aspects that I would say are fairly unique to my work. I don't know anyone else. I don't know if you do, Jim. I asked this before. Do you know anyone else who's saying that a human being might have a zero-point center, like an individual I that needs to be understood in this way? Do you know any of any writer or New Age person or anyone conceiving that?
No, I was meant to tell you that there's a book published by Samuel Weiser, which I've just ordered, called The God Hypothesis, and the guy talks about zero-point energy fields, and I'm very eager to see what he actually has to say about them. But he says that, you know, that light is consciousness, and that that this underlying material.
That's very
That's fantastic. I was so excited when I saw this, and I was waiting. I meant to tell you this, actually. I meant to email you this and just tell you
I'm
I just ordered
watch
this
for
book yesterday. His name is Heche, Bernard Heche. Do you know that name?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did he have
I think
that
I heard him on Coast to Coast.
Okay.
Yeah,
anyway.
Yeah,
but,
I did. I'm pretty sure I did.
I've seen little bits. No, the short answer is no, because I don't know anybody who has both like the heart doctrine and the idea of the singularity or the zero point and how that is applies on various levels, and so that you can understand that it's meant literally when the mystic aphorism, the microcosm of the macrocosm, you know, as above, so below, that these things actually describe literally the same creation dynamics of an individual and a cosmos, and nobody that I know even comes close to talking about that.
I was just going to say before we move on, you're saying like, see, other people write about the zero-point field. So people have the idea of there being zero-point fields, which are the electromagnetic fields latent within the quantum vacuum. Especially as you get down to Planckian lengths, the space is full of all these electromagnetic fields. So when you get down into Planckian levels, space is kind of full, infinitely full of this energy and vitality. So people have the idea of there being zero-point fields, but they don't then conceive that we might have a zero-point center existing within those zero-point fields.
Yeah.
You see? And that's what I'm trying to say. And that makes everything different. You see, that not only do we live within zero-point fields, but that we have a zero-point center tied into the physics of those zero-point fields. So this is, like, profoundly important aspect to it. Yeah. So we got two questions here. An email came in. Jim, why don't we just bring this up? Number one, what is deliverance? Wow. I see a human being, like I understand a human being in terms of four elements. And I would say that there's a spiritual spark in the human being, and that represents fire. And that element has three bodies representing the three modes of nature called tamas, rajas, and sattva, or meaning the material body, the emotional or energetic body, and the mental or intellectual body. So you have three vehicles, bodies, for the light of the spiritual spark. So a person in life is governed by the modes of nature, that you become conditioned into different modes of nature. And all your habit structures and emotional complexes, all that is stored in your breath and in your subtle bodies, all of these things serve to embody us more and more into the matrix of solidified existence. And so in a way, what we need to do in terms of deliverance, the soul is connected to the breath, so people have to learn to cultivate awareness in the breath and be breathing through different emotional complexes that bind their consciousness. And we want to be free, like through the awakening of consciousness within ourselves. We want to shed light on all of these complexes more and more to try to resolve them. And as we do that, we are less and less bonded by the modes of nature. And then what happens, you can undergo a transformation or awakening and attain to the level of the spiritual self. And the spiritual self, I'd connect to the heart, I'd connect it to consciousness, the light that illuminates you inwardly. So deliverance, in a way, is deliverance from conditioning or attachment, and that there are modes of transcendent existence that we can be conscious in which transcend the material world. So if we can be delivered in that sense, like delivered from the material world. And then there's the freeing of the inner, the jiva atma from the modes of nature. Swami Prabhupada in Krishna Consciousness talks of mukti. That's a liberation of the soul. And the liberation of the soul is from the three modes of nature. Okay, Jim, anything you want to comment on deliverance? Or
very good answer. I like that. I like what you said. I think the freeing, freeing from attachment and identification and the knots of the heart. I like your answer, though. I think that's a very, very good answer. I'm not sure it's right, but I mean, I like the answer. It's certainly consistent with my understanding.
Yeah, it's a complex question.
Well, you could take it on a whole bunch of different levels. I mean, deliverance. I mean, you could also say it's deliverance from the ego consciousness and a realization of God consciousness, which would be the complete transformation of self and the realization of the higher states of and apprehension of the higher realities. I suppose, you know, you could say that the deliverance from the illusory, from a maya, from the illusory world, the illusion of separateness and egoistic identity.
Let's stop. I'm going to stop you for a moment.
Yeah.
You went through such huge things. The first one was the deliverance of the ego into the self, and that's how we talk of self-realization, is a disillusion of the false mind into the lotus of the heart. So that's a deliverance from the false ego into that. Was beautiful how you expressed that. Okay. And then you went on, I'm trying to remember the next bit that you get. Oh, the deliverance from maya or illusion. The illusion is that we are simply the body, that the material world is all of existence, that this is our only life, that we are limited in the ways we think we are limited, and that we don't have psychic or occult powers or can't cultivate them. Those are illusions. The illusions of the permanency of life. People want to kind of think that life is permanent, but everything is transitory. There is not, everything is impermanent. The only thing that is not impermanent is the self. So we want to kind of experience ourself at that higher level of the permanency of I, and then experience within the matrix of creation. We want to try to learn to be established more in the inner experience of I at the center of the matrix. Okay, so Jim, so sorry, I can't stop you.
You just said such
big pieces.
It's just kind of stream of consciousness. I'm going to have to go back and listen when this show is archived, because I'm not really quite sure. I like what we kind of just generated in that. I thought your answer was very good, but it's a terrific question. It's a wonderful question, actually.
Yeah, and we've given some different angles on it. And then I was just going to say a last deliverance. I think humankind on this planet needs to be delivered out from under the control of the beast. That's what I think. The beast.
Yeah.
The beast that wants to devour the little sheep, or the beast that wants to have all the goats, the little goats going for it. I think there's a beast in modern times, and that humankind as a species needs to awaken to this and try to like tame the beast a little bit, and that there could be deliverance for the human race. I believe when the truth of 9/11 emerges into mass human global consciousness and the deviousness of these elites, that there will be a transformation. I think there'll be worldwide concerts, and all the holy world stars will shine out, and the human beings will have a great big party. That's what I hope.
I thought of another sense, too. My understanding of deliverance, in a way, is kind of is to deliver onto, like Gurdjieff says, like, you know, to lighten the sorrows of our common father, like the idea that by fulfilling our being obligations, we lighten the sorrows of God, you know, because it's one less burden that he has to carry in terms of, you know, like our heaviness and our ignorance in the modes of nature. Like if we realize ourselves as one with God, then we lighten his burden somehow, you know.
Yeah. It's funny. I feel that so much sometimes. I watch this song, this on YouTube. Listen to this piece of music, Jim. Where is the love? It's unbelievable, and the lyrics to it.
The Black Eyed Peas, is that who?
Yeah, Black Eyed Peas. Where is the love? It's so beautiful. What was my point going to be? I'm sorry, I slipped a bit. What had you just said, Jim? We were talking about deliverance.
Lightening the sorrows
The sorrows of our endlessness. And there was one version of that song that instead of being set to the Black Eyed Peas video, was set to all these scenes of Iraq and mutilated children and all the horrors of the warfare, and it plays against that song. It was just horrifying. I mean, it moved me so deeply. I went back to view it again, but it was kind of locked down, and you couldn't get to it unless you registered and so on. But even watching that song, and you know the case of that shooter in the States, Jim, at the Virginia conference?
Yeah. Were you in detective?
Remember on one occasion he identified himself to a girl through his email as ?
No.
Did you ever hear about that, what I'm talking about?
No.
Oh, he did anyway. But anyway, in this Black Eyed Peas, it begins with this piece of cloth with this big question mark on it. And it's like, where is the love? Where is the love in the world gone mad? And, you know, and bombs and the children. And so I see, sometimes it's like, I feel at times a bit bearing the sorrow of our endlessness. I feel that when sometimes it's so much just watching the news, seeing the horror of it all. I feel it within myself somehow, you know. So it would, you know, we need a new world. You know, I see how humanity as a species has poverty consciousness, the fear that there's not going to be enough. Okay, so we got to kind of kill other people or get rid of them or be in control so that there's going to be enough, kind of. And we've kind of wasted the world's resources in such devious, unnecessary things, that if there'd ever been, like, sane world government of any kind, like, even half-sane people, I mean, we could have had a kind of utopian society and world. But instead, there's these created, manufactured, synthesized terrorisms, you know? It's quite unbelievable. It's Satan and all his works. Not to put in there too much in religious terms.
In that essay I talked about, Henry Miller refers to that in Murder the Murderer, where he talks about, you know, we in America have an abundance of everything that we need. And he goes on, and he said, you know, I'm not just talking about the material thing, but, you know, if we really, you know, fulfilled the dreams of our poets and our inventors and our dreamers, you know, that we'd have everything that we could ever possibly want, you know, but somehow it's kind of lost in this nightmare of stupid consumer goods, you know, and things we don't need that are completely unnecessary, and we're kind of caught up in this nightmare. You know, he calls it the air-conditioned nightmare, you know, that's the title of one of his books. If people can find that essay, it was in a book called Remember to Remember by Henry Miller. I really urge them to read that essay. Like, I think it was written at the beginning. It's in two parts, at the beginning and after the Second World War. And it's quite amazing in the sense that he's a complete heretic in terms of what he says about the Second World War. But it's amazing how prescient he is in predicting what's going to happen afterwards. I mean, and I don't mean just after the war, but in the 60s and the 70s, the 80s, and now, you know, it's all quite quite consistent with his interpretation, which makes you wonder,
yeah,
like, how could anybody go against all the commonly held assumptions about the way things are and be so correct about things,
Yeah, it's funny. It's like, for me also, reading Gurdjieff is like that, like on the psychopathology of humankind.
And
Blavatsky, in her writings on the secret doctrine, the things she says about science back in 1888 are so pertinent to modern discussions of intelligent design and science and religion, but no one knows her work, you know?
Yeah,
all the
amazing
modern debate is on such superficial grounds. It really is. They argue back and forth, but no one knows what religion says and how, what science says and how they compare. You know, it's just,
In writing about your
work, the issue of human consciousness is the most profound existence question of existence, as well as of psychology and science. You know?
Yeah. What was the other question that we had?
Oh, yeah. And we've just got a couple minutes. I'll just make a note, and then we'll see what time we have to address this.
Yeah, okay.
I would encourage people to visit my website at www.zeropoint.ca. I'm sorry I haven't worked at my website much lately. I'm trying to revise my Divine Mysteries book further, and that's been taking my time. But I'll get to it. And we'll be back in 2 weeks. I'd like to thank James Moffitt, and I've been Christopher Holmes, and we had Connie Fogel from the Canadian Action Party today, and I hope we'll have further news and discussions with them. Okay, so we maybe got a minute left.
We have
in,
to thank
60 seconds, Jim. How does one renew spirit?
Listen to BBS Radio. I just wanted to get that in. Renew spirit? Is that the question? How does one renew spirit? I'm gone.